I know you've probably been around church a lot and heard those things, but there is something about like putting out your hands or raising your hands that can be cheesy, weird Christian stuff, but it can also be a powerful way of expressing your heart to God. If you are trying to surrender to him, if you're trying to put yourself before him. And there's also something about singing loudly that engages your heart, particularly if you're singing these songs and you just sense a dryness in you. You've probably been in seasons where like songs are really meaningful and then times when songs are really dry. That's okay. But one way to press into that is just be like, I don't care. I don't care about the dryness of my heart. God, your worthiness didn't change from the first time I sang to the last time I sang. You are still worthy of all of it. So I'm going to lift up my voice regardless of how I feel. So sometimes in the very midst of a cold, hard heart that feels callous and doesn't sense God's nearness, that's okay. His glory hasn't changed. Sing out all the louder. Like, I'm just going to lift my voice. The next four or five rows are going to have to deal with my voice being off tune. Maybe you're not the best singer, but just lift up your voice. So again, you guys sound great. It's a gift getting to sing with you. I want to start tonight, though, with, unfortunately, kind of an ugly painting. This is called Salvator Mundi, and it is the most expensive item ever sold at an auction. Yeah, I love Jesus, but Renaissance paintings of Jesus kind of creep me out, not going to lie. But this is the most expensive painting ever sold at an auction, most expensive item ever sold at an auction. And this is considered to be an original painting by Leonardo da Vinci. I always want to say Leonardo DiCaprio, but that's entirely different. Leonardo da Vinci. But interestingly, this had sold back in 1958 at an auction for $120. $120. Somebody thought it was by a follower of Da Vinci, didn't think it was an original, and said they bought it kind of an estate sale, $120. Guess how much this sold for in 2017? $450 million somebody paid for this painting. $450 million. Somebody bought it in 1958, like 50, 60 years before, $120. 60 years later, it's worth $450 million. It's the same painting. It did not change. But the value was immensely different. So hear this. Something is worth what you are willing to pay for it. Something is worth what you are willing to pay for it. So when you hold this question in your mind, what was God willing to pay for you? If you want to know your value, sit in that question with me. You want to know what you are worth, then tell me, what was God willing to pay for you? We're going to hear this tonight in John chapter 10 again. So if you have a Bible, open up with me there. We'd love to sit in God's word with you, but we're going to look at John chapter 10, verse 11. This is the only one I'm going to read for us. We have it up on a slide. We're talking about Jesus being the gate this morning, but he kind of keeps extending this metaphor. And he says this in John 10, verse 11. I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. Now, first of all, what I want you to grab from this passage is that the good shepherd is a role that belongs only to God. The good shepherd. There's other ways shepherd metaphors are used of kings and others that we'll hear, but the good shepherd, the right shepherd, the true shepherd is a label and role that only belongs to God. Only belongs to God. So if you were to go way out into Eastern religions like in India, you would hear people talk about God as almost a Star Wars-ish force that's in everything. So God is in the trees, God is in animals, God is in you, God is in me, God is in everything. And not just like God's presence, but actually God is those things. God is the flower. God is the animals. God's in everything. That's how Eastern people thought about God. If you go way into the West at Jesus' time, you'd hear that they had all sorts of different personalities and gods, from Zeus to Athena to all these different characters. And they were immensely powerful, but they had super shady character. So they would lie, they would cheat, they would hurt people. They were immensely powerful, but were not good. But the Jews were entirely unique in the world and in history. And not just saying this as a Christian, you can look this up from any kind of intellectual history. The Jews are unique. And they believe that there was only one God, not many like Western religions, just one God. And it wasn't just permeated throughout creation like Eastern religions thought, but God is entirely separate from this world. And he's the author and creator of it, but he is holy and not of our world. So they believed in one God who is entirely distinct from creation and holy, entirely different from us and unique and worthy of all praise and in control over all things. This is how the Jews viewed God. And they also would confess things like Psalm 23 that you've probably heard before. They would speak of their God saying, "Yahweh, the Lord is my shepherd." So he was unique and holy and set above the heavens, entirely different, but also aware of their lives and their shepherd. They also sometimes talked about kings and judges who ruled over the people as under shepherds, those that were responsible to God for how they cared for the people. And specifically in Ezekiel 34, we see God speaking to these kings and religious leaders for how they're misleading his people. And he says, one day God's going to take their leadership away from them, and guess who's going to come and lead in their place? God says this in Ezekiel 34. It says, "For this is what the sovereign Lord, only one King God, says, I myself will search for my sheep and look after them, as a shepherd looks after his scattered flock when he is with them. So will I look after my sheep." So they viewed that this one exalted God would one day come and shepherd and search after his sheep. So hearing this, catch again the audacity of Jesus as he says to everyone, "I am the good shepherd." Maybe to Eastern religions, that might not have been surprising, as the divine is in all things. Maybe to Western religions, that wouldn't be too shocking, as the gods showed up in all sorts of crazy ways. But to the Jewish people, to say that you are the good shepherd is to say you are the one ultimate God, maker of all things, residing among them, come to seek his people. So this could not be a more audacious claim than what Jesus is laying out. I am the good shepherd. I am God among you who has come to search for my people. Right after this verse, Jesus also lays out how there's a hired hand that does not own the sheep, but clearly the sheep belong to the shepherd. So if he's the good shepherd, who do the sheep belong to? They belong to him. But in Ezekiel, who do the sheep clearly belong to? God is saying, they are mine. So again, Jesus saying that he's the good shepherd and that the sheep belong to him means that he views himself as the one true God in the flesh come among us. And I say this because for your own intellectual honesty, you must get off the fence in your view about Jesus. You can't just view him as a great wise teacher who had some interesting things to say. Because if Jesus is making claims like this, he is the most manipulative and deceptive person in history. He's the greatest charlatan and deceiver that has ever lived, and we should view him as a crazy person. Even the Pharisees and others who are listening to Jesus say these things conclude this, saying he must have a demon. It's a right conclusion, based on what Jesus is saying if he is not telling the truth. So you have to get off the fence. Either view him as crazy or view him as God, but it's dishonest to sit on the fence and be apathetic about Jesus. Yeah, like, yeah, he's good. He's got some wise things to say. I might follow him in some ways. No, take a deeper look at who he is. Get off the fence. Get out of apathy. Either hate him or love him. Don't sit in between based on who Jesus is. Get off the fence. So first of all, the good shepherd is a role that belongs only to God. But secondly, I want to sit in this word, the good shepherd. He is the good shepherd. This means that the shepherd cares deeply for the sheep. And it means that he is excellent, excellent at being a shepherd and taking care of us. Again, I'm sure for a lot of you, you don't have like summer jobs where you work as a shepherd. That's not like a thing so much anymore. But again, in Jesus' day, people would have been well aware of what shepherding meant and how this task translated to God's care for his people. But I just want to walk through slowly some of the responsibilities of a shepherd to see how that communicates God's intense care for us as his people. And so first of all, shepherding included watching over the sheep day and night. This was ceaseless work to be a shepherd. You would watch over your sheep all day because some of them are really unruly and love to wander, as we'll get to, so you couldn't take your eyes off of them. You needed to keep bringing them in. And at night, you just couldn't shrug it off and just wander back home and leave the sheep out in the field. You had to take care of them all night too. This is why we talked about a sheep pen and that the shepherd would put them there and then lie down to sleep. It was the only way to keep them all gathered in and safe without you staying up all night. It was a demanding day and night task of watching over and being aware of your sheep. And secondly, you were also responsible for feeding and finding water for them every day. If you just leave sheep out in a field, eventually they will die because they won't take care of themselves. They need to find water every day. It's well known that sheep are among the most stupid animals on the planet, that they are very incapable of taking care of themselves. And so even when you take them to a watering source, if it's really fast-moving river, sheep will get scared and they won't drink out of it. And the same if you take them to a stagnant source of water. They might drink out of that, but they would easily get sick. So the shepherd has a challenge. He needs to find running water, but water that's not running too fast to scare the sheep. He needs to find quiet streams of water every day. Same with food. It was a constant struggle. In the spring in the Judean foothills, there'd be enough water that the whole hillsides would bloom and be full of grass. But as summer went on, the pastures would get fewer and fewer. Until later in the fall, you'd be struggling and wandering all over with your sheep, trying to find green pastures for them. And in the winter, you might be full, like trying to forage from trees and bring down leaves for the sheep. You're doing everything you can in your power to feed your sheep, and it's on you or they die. So you're constantly thinking about watering and feeding your sheep daily. More than this, it wasn't just a flock to a shepherd, but the shepherd knew each sheep individually and would have a name for each one. Like blackface over there, white toe, you know, like all of these different names that they would have for each sheep. You know, all of the different characteristics and ears and faces, they would just name each one based on the way it looked or other nicknames. They knew each one individually. And not just a whole flock again, but they had specific care so that in the morning, as I mentioned today, they could say their name and call them out to follow them. And the sheep would know their voice and listen to them and follow them. But a stranger's voice they would resist and be afraid. But the shepherd knew each one individually, knew them by name. Because of this, at night, they would also have them pass under their staff, and they would check them to make sure they were healthy. They would look at their faces to see if they had any scratches, if there was any disease. So they were examining them to check their health. If they saw any wounds on their body, any scratches, they would put oil on them, acting as a veteran and a doctor for them. "You anoint my head with oil," David says in Psalm 23. So they know their names. They're constantly caring for them. But also, if a sheep happened to wander away, a shepherd would go and seek it out. No matter the time, no matter the amount of care, they would find their sheep. And sometimes if they saw a sheep start to wander off a path, they would have a sling, and they would put a stone in the sling. And sometimes they would cast it just beyond the sheep, so the rock would land nearby and then scare the sheep back towards the shepherd. So he's trying to corral it in by throwing a rock beyond it so it would hear that noise and come back towards the rest of the flock. And if one got even farther away than that or fell into a ravine or got lost in the hills, the shepherd would search and search and search until he finds it. And often a sheep would get exhausted from wandering away. So the shepherd, as you might see in some images of Jesus, he would put it on his shoulders and carry it back home. On his shoulders, taking the weight and care for the sheep. And lastly, it wasn't just all of these tasks because of how ornery and ridiculous and difficult sheep could be, but also had to be cautious around predators that would be trying to take advantage of them. So you have to protect. You hear David, who worked a long time as a shepherd, testify to this, saying that there were bears and lions that would come against his sheep. And a shepherd didn't just stand by and watch as it just would ravage the flock. He would intercede and fight off these wild animals. Goats and others, they'll disperse and run away or actually kind of get together in a ring to protect themselves. They'll actually come together to fight. But sheep, they just scatter and they just run. And they are the easiest prey for predators. So without a shepherd, they are helpless. So the shepherd was constantly watching over them to protect them from wild animals. Do you see why, when the Jews are wanting to speak about the kindness and thoughtfulness and the goodness and protection of God, they would want to say, "The Lord is my shepherd. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters." Do you see that God is aware of you night and day? That he does not sleep or slumber, but sees your life specifically? Do you know that God knows you by name and is aware of every detail in your life, that he has counted every hair on your head? Do you know that even when you are wandering and you are chasing other things and leaving the life he intends for you, he seeks you out and does not tire, does not give up after a year or a decade, but God continues to seek those that belong to him and he will not give up. What a good thing for those of us who particularly are rebellious that you have a God that will not give up. I might tire, I might get exhausted, but our good shepherd will not give up. He will seek you and he will carry you home on his shoulders. And he is aware of how to bind up your wounds. In fact, that by his wounds, you are healed. He is the good shepherd, entirely aware of our needs and knowing how to lead us to life-giving places. So see that as Jesus says, "I am the good shepherd," he is the one who is most excellent at taking care of you and I, most excellent at leading us. He's the one that we need. But lastly here, this good shepherd also means that he is giving us his life. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. mentioned this earlier, this question of how much is God willing to pay for you? We see Jesus answer this question repeatedly. If you read through John chapter 10, 11 through 21, this section, you'll hear numerous times Jesus says, I lay down my life for the sheep, and it's not taken from me. I willingly lay down my life for the sheep. And so it could not be a more costly gift that he gives to you and I. He could not pay a higher price. Again, it's not some other person alone. This is God in the flesh who is giving his very life for you. He's not paying in half the universe. He's not giving angels or money or gold or the universe for you. He is giving his very life. Nothing is more worthy, nothing is more glorious than God himself. So you could not have greater worth, greater value than what you are shown in the death of Jesus for you. God could not make a greater statement of your worth than what he does on the cross to purchase you with his life. This is amazing too, because Jesus isn't saying that he would risk his life for the sheep. He's not saying that he might throw his life out there, but maybe he wouldn't need to, but he knows, I will, in fact, fully and completely lay down my life unto death for these people. It's not a what if, it is a certainty for him. I will die for these people. This is what it means for him to lay down his life. He's not risking it. He's giving it completely. I want you to see the gravity of this, because you might have heard so often of Jesus giving his life in exchange for you. So I want to switch this to another story of how this has happened before. Several years ago, I got the opportunity to go to Poland with some people, and we stopped and saw Auschwitz, which is one of the most well-known concentration camps from World War II, where thousands and thousands of Jews were heartbreakingly killed at these concentration camps, among many other people. And there's one major part of the camp that's kind of out in the fields away from a town, but there's another part of Auschwitz that was a labor camp. It was used especially at the beginning of the war. And they would send out these prisoners during the day to go do labor, either building railroads or fences or other projects, and then they would bring them back at night into the concentration camp. But in order to make sure that none of these prisoners ran away, they made a rule that if anyone is found missing at the end of the day, they would immediately choose 10 people and take them to the side, and they would put them in a basement room for 14 days without food, without water, until they died. So anyone knew that if I run away, that will immediately mean 10 people die in my place. And so one day, the people went out to work, and they came back, and they did the roll call, and they found that 3 people were missing. 3 people had ran off. And so the SS guards immediately choose 10 people, and they start to take them to this room, this basement, and one man just starts to cry out for help, and he's begging the guards for his life. He's talking about how he has a wife, and he has kids at home, and he cannot die. He promised he'd come back to them. His heartbreaking moment, and as he's begging for his life, they're not giving him any mercy. And in seeing this, there's a priest that steps out of line who was one of the prisoners, and he volunteers his life for this man. And the guards are shocked by this, but they let it happen. They let the man who was begging for his life get back into line, and they let the priest step in along with the other 9 instead. And they take him down into this basement room, and for 14 days, they're not given any water or any food. And we know this story because there are living witnesses who saw this moment, multiple witnesses that testify about this priest offering his life, stepping in to die in place of this man. And people said, too, that he was actually the only one that lived after that 14 days and had to be executed by the SS guards. But can you imagine that moment with me? Of someone begging for their life, facing death, and you step in knowing with certainty that it will be the end of your life. Can you imagine someone doing this for you out of such care, out of such love, that they would take your place? Again, this is a true story from history, but what I'm telling you about Jesus is also true and in history. That you have had someone lay down their very life for you. It might unfortunately still be a story in your mind, but that doesn't make it any less of a reality. God himself has laid down his life for the sheep. He didn't risk it. He gave it completely and to the full. So sit in that and let your heart wonder, what must I be worth to you, God, that you were willing to pay this price for me? Again, what must I be worth to you, God, that you were willing to pay this price for me? Would you guys pray with me again? Lord, I pray that you would help us taste this truth. The gospel is something we're always bringing out in the church, trying to highlight, trying to make clear. But Lord, I recognize that this is beyond my power. Lord, this is a work of your Holy Spirit. So especially for these students that have heard about your death for them numerous times, God, would you make it real to them tonight? That they would sense and see just what you have given for them, the reality of this. Lord, their worth in your eyes, that you have come to lay down your life for them. Lord, would they in turn surrender themselves to you? We pray this in your good name, Jesus. Amen. Thanks again for listening, everybody. You are dismissed. Hey, man. Yes, thanks for coming up and saying hello.
All right, so I wanted to mention that there's actually some other